Good morning. I think we'll get started, even though there will be others that will be joining us. Before I make a few introductory remarks, I would ask that you turn off your cell phones. Turn them off. Don't just put them on silence because it interferes with our sound system. My name is David Smock. I'm one of the vice presidents here at USIP. And head up the Religion and Peacemaking Program. 2.5 years ago, we co-hosted with Catholic University and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy a delegation of 9 religious leaders from Iran who spent a week here in what turned out to be very illuminating and productive discussions. And we have been thinking for some time since then about what might make a natural and fruitful follow-up to that delegation's visiting here. And we decided that it would be best to have a delegation of American Muslim scholars go to Iran and meet with their counterparts there. And rather than organizing this directly ourselves, we approached our good friend Muhammad Abu Nimer and his colleagues at the Salam Institute, Peace and Justice Institute, and asked if they would take on the responsibility for organizing the visit. And they jumped at the opportunity, and we've had a very fruitful collaboration with the Salam Institute in organizing this project. The plan was to focus on Islamic peacemaking, but also address the various issues that divide our two countries, hoping for a deeper understanding of Iranian culture, politics, and religious life. It's a little unclear what will follow now, but we have been having tentative discussions about inviting an Iranian delegation of scholars on Islamic peacemaking to come here sometime in 2008. And the delegation had some preliminary discussions of that possibility when they were in Iran, and the Iranians were enthusiastic about it. The delegation of 7 American Muslims who went on this trip was headed up by Professor Muhammad Abu Nimer, who is a professor at American University and, as I indicated, director of the Salam Institute. And Muhammad is soon to be a senior fellow at USIP, and we're looking forward to his joining us here. The delegation was co-headed by my colleague, Dr. Kamar Al-Huda, who's a senior program officer in the Religion and Peacemaking Program here and formerly a professor of theology at Boston College and other universities. And the third member of the delegation who will be joining us in making a presentation this morning is Dr. Aisha Kadirsky-Oriana, who is also a professor at American University and, as with her colleagues, a specialist on Islamic peacemaking. Muhammad will start us off, and Muhammad, if you'll come up here. Why?
Morning. Thank you for coming such early time here. I know the commute could be hard, but we'll try to share with you some of our impressions and experience with this delegation to Iran. My job here is to do a little bit of an overview of the background a little bit and the motivation for our trip, and also show you some pictures so you could see the context of the delegation, as well as some of the impressions and the findings that we will put out. Obviously, we are indebted to the United States Institute for Peace for the support, as well as the facilitation of the trip in various ways, including the process of visa, as well as contact in the counterpart in Iran. I usually ask my before any trip or before any project, I ask people to list few preconceived notion about Iran, and I did this exercise in those 2 weeks, 3-4 times, and the answer to this question usually is interesting. So I do invite you to write down one word or two for yourself, or think about what's the preconceived notion that you have about Iran. Some of the audience that I had, they spoke about primitive, antagonistic, fanatic, radical, everybody is covered, even men in the street. There is no infrastructure, and also there is no any form of freedom of expression at all. This is sort of the, I think, extreme version, but the others were, I think, more realistic in their views and more aware of the dehumanization as well as mispresentation of the Iranian society, in the general media. But it's amazing how even people like ourselves, who are supposed to be more informed about international relations and politics and also Middle East, ourselves were shocked by some of the things that we've encounter there in terms of diffusing our own stereotypes and our own misperception, and it took at least in the first day or two in order to overcome the tendency to seek a confirmation for these negative stereotypes, which is usually a struggle with people who come to a place like Iran or Palestine or Israel or Afghanistan or Iraq, and then you're really looking for things to confirm your preconceived stereotypes or notion. We prepare for, we had 13 members and six of them, 13 members of Muslim who were with us, and 2 weeks before, six of them dropped, primarily for, at least three of them dropped for security reason. They did not feel comfortable that they can make the trip and still come back and be safe, particularly the concern with U.S. immigration, and they didn't want to take the risk, despite the fact that we brought a letter from the USIP, a letter, a confirmation from the U.S. government and contact and try to facilitate that. But I think their fears were more related to security. Our visa approval took about a year and a half, almost 13 months in order to get that in place. Our objective were basically tied to the, we're not an interfaith delegation, we're mainly looking at Muslim delegation. And the rationale behind that was mainly to Again, probably a more in-depth entry. If we went as an interfaith dialogue, we were expecting to see, you know, to face the typical classic Muslim-Christian relation where it's very hard to get to a deeper layer of conversation. So we thought we can make a connection as Muslim Americans who work for peace, and it did work a little bit. I'll speak about it once we managed to convince our partners there that we are not really interfaith, although we have two convert and five other delegation members. Still, it took a while to overcome that. This is our Dallas Airport check, and we got the VIP treatment, but I'm not sure it's because Iran or because we're Middle Eastern. It could be totally random, but we definitely got a very fast track to go into. This is the view. They put us in the dorms of the university for security reason also and finance, and this is the northern view from the dorm. I don't know what you thought, how it looked like, the same view from here. Our host was the UNESCO chair for human rights, peace, and democracy. And some people even could not believe that there is something like that in Iran. So this was the first, sharing of it. And there are six human rights organizations that they spring off of this institute in Beheshit Shahid University in Tehran. And one of them actually was closing about a month and a half, I think, before we arrived. So our host was tense a little bit. Because one of the chairs of the human rights was critical of the policy, and they decided to close it, so they were concerned. This is our first encounter with them, and this is really the center there with the delegation member as well. Our initial visit, it's interesting, we decided to share this with you also. As people come here, we take them to the mall and to show them the capital and show them different places that reflect our national founding fathers. And people insisted as the first step of the program to go to Khomeini's house and the mosque where he preached after the revolution. And we went there, and it was an interesting visit. And our host, who basically were reformist as well as a critical of the government policy as well, but also insisted that we go there for various reasons. I think part of it is government pressure. There was a clear, there was a surveillance there in that sense, and I think it was good for us and for them that we visit. This is the neighborhood, and this is a typical mural for the Khomeini in Tehran and also other places. The Mahdi picture is there as well. This is the area how sort of the entry to the place. This is the simple. The message was simplicity. Our leader is simple. His style of life was simple. And the simplicity is much appreciated in both Shia and Sunni context. We were accompanied by students, five students or six students for 24 hours. They actually lived with us in the same building. And we got a great hospitality as well as care from these master students who were interested in human rights, peace, and conflict resolution, really eager to connect with us as American Muslim as well as people who work in this field. Shahid Beheshti University is one of the largest in Tehran, and you could see also the mural there. This religion, separation of religion and the state academic, is something that my American AU students found it strange to comprehend that this would be in the university, but I think it's part of the setting as well. Khamenei as well as Khomeini also were present in the campus as well as part of the background for the context. Despite the people thinking that everybody is going to be fully covered with hijab as well as niqab, or this is a typical student look there. We met really three groups, and our meeting was with the secular humanist. I'm not sure if secular would be the right term here, but who argued that Islam is peace, but leave it out of politics. And it was interesting. We had one day a conference in Shahid Beheshti University, and we found ourselves as American Muslim delegation interested in religion and peace, at some point really debating with some of the hosts that we have whether religion has anything to do with politics, and some of them were arguing, let's leave it outside of politics. This is in Iran. This is in Tehran. We are arguing that argument with them. It felt a bit ironic. Islam, the second group, said the reformist, Islam is necessary for state, but needs to be reformed. And those were more of the critical of the policy, as well as critical of the way how too much intervention of religious as well as clergy into the both public and the private life of academician and the students and society, and they were looking for more reform. I met also a third group who said the current system is working fine, the mix between state and religion is well balanced, and we don't need to look at that, as well as we don't need to revise it or remove it in that sense. One of the group that we met with was the reformist, and we met with the Khatami Civilizational Dialogue Institute and also the Academy of Science. Both of them were very strong in promoting intrafaith dialogue, as well as some civil society work in Iran itself. And they were sharing with us lots of the projects that they have created locally as well as internationally, with an office also in Switzerland, and they invited us for one of their evening session here to share with them some of the information. And among those are Deputy Foreign Minister during Khatami and other high-level officials who were part of the Iranian government during Khatami as well. We also went to the Academy of Science, which is one of the most prestigious intellectual and academic institution in Tehran, hosted, created, I think, or head by Khatami as well. Ayatollah Jinati in the middle, as in many other meetings we have, the Ayatollah will start the blessing of the meeting as well as put some context to our conversation. What I recall from this meeting was the conversation, what we propose, should there be a, can interfaith dialogue work, can intrafaith dialogue work, do we need to invest in that direction? And they invited about 15 intellectuals, as we told later on, were one of the top intellectuals in Tehran. It was interesting, one of their leader of these sociologists and historian put the hypothesis that we cannot achieve reconciliation or peace. What we can hope for is really a level of passive tolerance between or among religion and also between Shia and Sunni, and we should not be more idealistic in expecting a full reconciliation and harmony between religion. But it would be great success if we can expect just passive tolerance. Leave us alone, we'll leave them alone, and we will be coexisting under the rule of law, international rule of law. And I think, you know, we spent about half an hour at least debating that point, whether that's really a good measure and expectation to prevent violence. Our hypothesis was that with the passive coexistence, you don't have any guarantee for preventing violence, particularly between communities in places like Iraq or Iran or other or Lebanon, where the passive coexistence have existed for many years, but with the change of demography, change of politics, the violence usually emerge easily after that. One of the other observations I wanted to put forward was that you walk really, and I work in Sri Lanka, Philippines, Palestine, I've been to Bosnia, I've been to many war zone area, and the feeling I got looking at the public space there, there is constant reminder how much a threat external, as well how much sacrifice we have done as in our society, as Iranian in that sense, if I take the identity there, and also reminder of the war. This is a child during the Iraq war, the first Iraq war, who basically approach an Iraqi tank, throw a grenade in the tank, and it was elevated to a hero, and saw him in several mural in Tehran. Constant reminder, it doesn't really feel that the society have totally recovered from the war of Iraq, Iran-Iraq war, as well as the threat from the outside. But this is a typical entry for us in other conflict area to do peace building and work. One of the things we noticed in Tehran in our meeting that we were circulating among a little bit of critical humanist as well as opposition group, so we wanted to meet also with the people from the religious and the clergy, and there is no better place than Qom to do that. So we spent another 3 days in Qom, where we met with the first Zalhawza Al-Ilmiya from Al-Fatima Al-Masuma, which is basically one of the well-known, I think 23 different schools or madrasa, but it's not really madrasa, is not the appropriate term for that, more of a university, a religious or theological seminary probably is more interested. My image, I'll share it with you, I didn't expect such well-maintained, beautiful, interesting structure as well, and got into Al-Hawza Al-Ilmiya, and we began our conversation, and I've discovered that these are really vibrant schools of thought, and they contributed significantly to the Shia current Islamic intellectual. It's really stepping into this vibrant, dynamic intellectual debate about Islam, about the sources of Islam, both in Sharia, fiqh, as well as politics as well. Many of their leaders, the scholars, they seek to engage with the outside. In every meeting we had, they ask us for what can we do together, what type of research you're interested in, how could we bring our students, your students, how could we build the bridges with you in that direction. I've noticed that several Europeans have already made their contact with some of these seminary. Actually, a couple of them came to our meetings. I didn't meet one single American scholar or, not to say tourist, of course, in Qom. But it was interesting to see European scholars who interested in this theme, who have basically, even two of them were teaching in some of these seminary as well, and the Islamic seminary has offered them opportunities to do that. In each of these meetings with those ulama or religious clergy and scholars, we posed the question, should we discuss the Shia-Sunni relation and is there a crisis that needs to be addressed? We got mixed responses. Yes, there is a crisis and we need to look at it. And interfaith dialogue is something important, but we don't have a space and capacity to launch into something like that. This were, I think, a minority. The majority of people did not feel comfortable addressing that publicly as well. And in fact, you know, many times they'll start the meeting with us as we are interfaith. I mean, they see the American and they don't go beyond that. And it takes about 15 minutes to tell them we're not only American, but we're also Muslim. We're not only Muslim American, we're also interested in peace and conflict resolution. And to get to that level, it takes about an hour. Once we get to that conversation in the seminar, I think we get to see how different Shia schools or different Shia scholar approach and frame the notion of conflict resolution and peace. In this specific meeting, the dialogue took us to the debate about the condition for war, for a just war, as well as the concept of jihad. We touch upon that. But they were eager to continue this conversation and talk about these subjects with us. And again, we try to put an agenda for Sunni-Shia dialogue as they are considered the hub or the center for this type of work. And they were very open to it, especially in this Hawza al-Ilmiya. One of the things that we've noticed, and I've written at least one book and many articles about this notion of Islam and peace, and I've done that from a typical Sunni perspective, both theologically and sociologically. And when in one of the conversation we had, I asked, you know, how do you educate for peace and tolerance and conflict resolution and justice? And this is a typical story when Imam Ali meets a Christian beggar during his caliphate, and he says, you know, you use him or you utilize him during his youth or when he was young man, and now look at him as old man. We're not caring for him, and he instructs his assistant to give him a pension from the Islamic, from Bayt al-Mal, or from the pension for the Muslim state at that time. The same exact story, I've seen it to Umar ibn al-Khattab, who's known for the Sunni as the justice caliphah, with also validated attribution. But it's interesting to see that Shia and Sunni use different or same stories with different attribution, and that's usually the case in this peace and conflict resolution field from an Islamic perspective. They usually insist that we take a picture after each and to commemorate that, and usually put it on their website. So, by the way, each of these Hawza al-Ilmiya has websites, a well-developed library, and a group of researchers. What we notice also, one thing that many of them, or at least the people who met with us, an average of out of 10, probably will be 5 or 6 of them who've been educated in Europe and some in the U.S., and when they got their secular or Western education, they went back and continued their Islamic education. So they really seasoned into those two worlds, the Islamic Shia world as well as the Western world. In Qom, we decided to meet or wanted to meet with the Ayatollah as the several grand Ayatollah, and we met with the three of them, Ayatollah Wahid, Ayatollah Ardabili, as well as Ayatollah Sani'i. Sani'i probably considered, as we told, one of the more influential Ayatollah right now. In fact, we were meeting with him, and I'll show you his picture in a few minutes, who cut the meeting short and said, I have to meet with the head of the parliament. And indeed, we went down, and you know, the head of the parliament was there also to with his entourage, at least, to meet with him. It was interesting to hear those Ayatollah and their involvement in politics and their views. This is Ayatollah Sani'i, very vibrant, again, dynamic presenter, one of the most dynamic presenters there, very receptive and was open to the question. The question you put to him were the status of women, a human rights issue, the question of war and violence in Islam. And he has done sort of a great deal of writing about these topics and enjoyed the conversation as well. The three Ayatollah we met with were very clear that they asserted positively the concept of interfaith and interfaith dialogue. They were interested in that, and they said we need to carve more space for it. They did express concern about the current crisis, and we did not talk about nuclear crisis. We talked about crisis in general, but the reference was to the U.S.-American relation. And they all said that this should be diffused non-violently and through negotiation. They all recognized, it was interesting, the three of them recognized very clearly that they don't only blame the U.S. for the escalation in the rhetoric in terms of dealing with this crisis, but also they were critical of their own government as well as the policy that were done. Even, you know, one of them said, you know, it seems that our leader got in a tree and don't know how to get down of this, this position. And I said, you know, we could say the same thing about our leadership as well. One of the scholars said, you know, Iran needs to reach out to the world more, and we heard that also in Tehran as well. The sense of isolation, the sense of, you know, we're really alienated from the world has at least emerged with my informal conversation with several people in Tehran as well as Qom, and it was interesting to see it from one of the most influential ayatollah that we met with. This theme that all humans are from the same origin, we all have the same pain, the same victimhood, and this connection for similarities was the same theme, which is I usually find it in interfaith dialogue as well as in Islam and peace. The emphasis on similarities, the emphasis on the shared humanity for all people, and this should be really emphasized, and all the ayatollah did emphasize it. A need for Muslim unity also was a theme that we heard a lot. Finally, the notion of the Islamophobia. Almost in six or seven of those meetings in Qom and Tehran, you know, it's as of the gate for the conversation has to be about the sense of Islamophobia, the sense that Islam and Muslim, both of them are under attack, and as a result, they need to defend themselves. We need to defend ourselves because of this increasing violence, increasing sense of attacks against Muslim. Ayatollah Wahid did not take any picture with us. He didn't feel comfortable to be in public at all. He said, for the last 20 years, as I understood, never appear in any picture. So we settled with his assistants, and this is his office setup. Again, we went to the study Center for Comparative Religion, where there were about 60 or 65 books on comparative religion, and found a couple of European researchers there who doing interfaith dialogue and also trying to move with that direction of research as well. This is one of the difficult, I think more realistic meeting that we had in that sense. And this is the final meeting we had in Qom. And this was the association for the Al-Hawza Al-Ilmiya, the 20 Hawza or seminary. They had, as you see, the camera. And whenever the camera is in the room, usually people change their conversation. And we didn't understand what's happening. But the entire, we kept saying interfaith dialogue, peace, conflict resolution. We would like to have more conversation on that. And the official line was more on why jihad is our right, why the resistance of the violence, and why defending our homeland is the main thing we should focus on. And the meeting went for about an hour and a half exactly on that subject. So it didn't really go further. But when the camera was shut off, you could see that there was a little bit of a possibility for a different conversation. And this probably was one of the only public media coverage for our work. We try to keep it very low profile in that sense. What does conflict resolution, academic institution in the Iran? In most settings, when the concept of peace politics was discussed, there are several points that resistance and defending Muslim rights to practice their religion and land is legitimate. Not very different from the Sunni conversation in Egypt, in Palestine, in Mindanao, wherever I do this work. This line of defensive Islam always emerged in the beginning. And also that there is an active Islamophobia attack against Muslim. And also Muslim, when they react to this attack of Islamophobia, their reaction should be defensive and according to the nature of the faith, which is really more of a restrict your reaction. So extreme violence, extreme measures in reaction to the Islamophobia was delegitimized in that sense. Dialogue and interfaith understanding is a preferable the Islamic way. There is no substantial direct This is one of our findings when we kept asking for material, classes, curriculum about the Shia perspective on Islam and peace. They said, we deal with that. We don't have a special class for it, but we deal with these concepts throughout all our classes. And we mainstream it. And it reminded me with our dealing with the gender. Whether we mainstream gender in development or we take one class to it and we say to our students, here is the gender, you sort of compartmentalize it. And they said, we did not compartmentalize it yet. We've mainstream it. But again, it was very difficult to find a specific curriculum, and I'm not sure the level of trust was there for them to give us their curriculum and hand it to us and say, this is what we're teaching as well. All the academicians we meet with welcome the connection with American Muslim and non-American Muslim as well. Finally, we went to Isfahan, and Isfahan was a beautiful as well city, and just incredible scenery as well as hospitality we got from the Bar Association in Isfahan. There we had about 200 people in a seminar that we did with the panel, the seven of us, and the students were engaged, male and female, and faculty were also engaged with us and asked us some questions. La ilaha illallah, Ali, Wali Allah, as well Muhammad Rasulullah. Coming from a Sunni, again, background from, and I was in Saudi Arabia in November, so really, for a Sunni to be there, it's very different take on it, and was an eye-opening. In brief, all the Ayatollah we met, we somewhat critical of the policy of escalation and want Iranian and USA government to talk. Most people met were eager to establish contact. They all condemned any attempt to use violence to solve the crisis. And most important, I think the last point, they warned us, both conservative, reformist, and people also were critical of the regime, that any violence attack against Iran, it will put them on the defensive. And the historian professor in Tehran took me to the side during the dinner and said, you know, many of us really would love to reconnect with the U.S. culturally as well as politically, but you should know that in any event where Iran is attacked by the U.S., we all have to defend our country, and that will destroy much of our work as reformists as well as people who are trying to promote democracy in that government or in that context. We suggested three things as well as follow up, and also find it very helpful for this effort. 2 weeks ago there was a suggestion from the Democracy Committee here on the Capitol to actually do a parliamentary as part of exchange program for our politician. I think it would be a great idea to do that, as Nancy Pelosi did with Syria. I think it would be much needed, something like this. Include Iran in the State Department citizen exchange program. We do that and spend lots of finance or money on all the exchanges, and we don't have one for Iran. I think that's something that would be very helpful for breaking these images, mutual images. And to support the peace and conflict resolution programs between U.S. and Iran, open more channel of communication with moderate Iranian who are interested in that, support more objective, responsible media coverage, particularly with the U.S. government-sponsored media. And we have some of those where the sponsor media has been contributing to the dehumanization of the other side. And I think our trip conveyed that American Muslim can be a good connection with the Iranian as well, and this might be supported with this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed, for that nice introduction and a comprehensive introduction. I guess it's a part of our work as a conflict resolution scholars and practitioners to start with our own stereotypes and start deconstructing them. I too had many interesting stereotypes which I didn't even realize before I went to Iran. So I would like to start with some of my preconceived ideas about Iran and how they have been transformed through this experience with our project. One of the things that I had in mind was that Iran would be very conservative, religion would be in the minds and words of everyone. And it was a big surprise for me to see that many of the people that we met were not very religious or not very practicing Muslims, especially in Tehran. And I had the idea of that I had to be covered fully, I ended up being quite often, especially in Tehran and Isfahan, the most covered or most conservative-looking person with my long Saudi outfit. And it was surprising for me to see women very vocal, and women and men both were very well educated, not only in terms of their fields, but also literature, art, music. But at the same time, when we say these people are not religious or they didn't claim to be religious themselves, religion did play an important role in their cultural context. People, who, for example, who said they were not religious could recite the Quran out of their head in such beautiful ways that was really impressive. So you could see that there was the religion as an authoritarian regime can be very overwhelming to people. At the same time, as a cultural background, it influences the way they think, they live their lives in different ways. So that was something very interesting. Also, meeting some of these Grand Ayatollahs was an interesting experience for me. Is that better? Thank you. For example, Ayatollah Sanai, who was, in my opinion, very progressive in his work on women's issues, women's rights issues, and rights of non-Muslims are also very interesting to me, which I will talk a little bit more when I will talk about approaches to human rights. And another concern I had was I was actually the only woman delegate on the team. The other lady was accompanying her husband, and I was so grateful that she was with us, actually, because most of the time I was the only woman out there, except in Isfahan. And but at the same time, it was very interesting to see majority of the students were women. That was a very interesting dynamic. But I was also surprised, in a good way, to see the openness to hear my voice and shown respect there as an equal member of the delegation as well. So my concerns were quickly dispelled. We met very interesting groups of people. We met people from the civil society. We met academicians. We met students. We met religious leaders of conservative traditions or progressive leanings. And our focus was peace and conflict resolution in Islam. And one of the things we were told later on, after establishing some sort of trust between our hosts and the people that we met, that it did help them and us that we were Muslim. We came there as a Muslim delegation. First of all, it helped them with the government, but after a while, it also helped us to get more candid discussions going into the certain debates about historical, economic, and interpretation challenges that Muslims are facing today. Most of the scholarship on peace and conflict resolution there was dealt from an international law perspective, and there was a strong emphasis on human rights issues as well as interfaith and intrafaith issues. So, for example, the peace was defined as positive peace and would emphasize the importance of rights of all individuals, irrespective of race, gender, ethnicity, and religion. For example, Grand Ayatollah Sanai talked about and has significantly written books and articles about the rights of women and the rights of non-Muslims. And his focus was, in the Islamic tradition, the important concept is justice. And all who don't do good, irrespective of their religious tradition, are recognized in the eyes of God. Therefore, we should care and love, show love for those people who are good. And he also referred to a hadith from Ali, Imam Ali, saying that you're either brothers in religion or brothers in creation. So we all go back to the same family, so we're all one family. And that in Islamic tradition, he also argued that peace is not only about plain justice, but also friendship and love, and that we have to also conceptualize our notions of democracy based on this, not only voting, but showing an active love and caring to all members of our society. And he also talked about that if a leader who is not loved or who is not who did something wrong should be removed from office. And another important institution that we met was called Islamic commission, Islamic Human Rights Commission, and there was something that's interesting about this commission because, first of all, they did work on human rights from an Islamic framework, and they emphasized why that was important in the Iranian context. How, for example, when they were dealing with issues of human rights abuses at the government level, for example, to frame those issues within the Islamic sources provides them a legitimacy. And that way, for example, if there's a fatwa that they feel is against some human rights issues, they can produce counter fatwas. And so that's the way they deal with it. And another way they deal with the human rights abuses was that they, contrary to other NGOs, they're linked with the government, meaning although there's no guarantee that they will not publish it, they don't usually publish their work. But they communicate directly with government and try to influence the government action. This way, they try to keep going on and doing work. So that was one challenge they faced because some organizations, they felt or they said they were didn't consider them as transparent. But he was mentioning what some of the challenges of working in an authoritarian system and how creative ways we have to engage in trying to address real problems of human rights. And he also mentioned that in addition to many of the reports and other things that they've been publishing on various issues, they have had limited success in citizenship rights, for example, rights of the child, rights of non-Muslims, rights of women's issues. But he also mentioned that political issues like association, press, freedom of press, freedom of speech have been more difficult for them to address, and they've been struggling. And they also mentioned the importance of how the Iranian society is usually very aware of what's going on, and the society is very dynamic in demanding their rights, and they do it in very creative ways. For example, he talked about a person who was prisoned, and what his friends did was to connect with him through a phone, but then that conversation was broadcasted on the campus so that everybody could hear. So they were trying to do sort of creative ways. And you also mentioned about another interesting thing when another NGO was confiscated, but the people who came to the NGO found that the people who confiscated all their documents had prepared them tea. And wore hot tea when they came. So it's kind of interesting, the different things that was going on in the society. But they also mentioned that currently the situation was a little dimmer than before, and that there was a mood was very down, and even many religious leaders who have been working on these issues of human rights have not been forthcoming as often as they used to. So they also mentioned that. Another theme that was very prevalent in our discussion on peace and conflict resolution was the importance of religious dialogue, dialogue between religious traditions. Mohammed, my colleague, mentioned Hatemi. He's been very active in trying to bring a dialogue between different civilizations, and we were told that they're preparing a meeting in Egypt and another one in Turkey to bring religious leaders from around the world to have a dialogue between civilizations. And another institute that I thought was quite interesting was the World Religious Research Center in Qom, which we visited. And one thing that was interesting for us is that there was this German, I think, a scholar there. And one of the things they said their aim was to try to understand each religion as their own followers would understand, rather than giving an Islamic spin or how we think their religion is. And they had three departments. One was the department on Islamic religions, the other one was Abrahamic religions, and the third one was non-Abrahamic religions. And they had various publications, as Mohammed mentioned, and they had a journal called Seven Heavens. I had a chance to go and visit their library, and I was truly impressed. Just looking at the English books, I saw books from Mahabharata, Upanishad, Zohar, which is the mystical Jewish tradition, all of Mishnahs and Talmuds, and some very interesting and cutting-edge works on Islam and women issues, progressive Muslims. So I thought that was just the English section was very impressive, and I didn't have much time to go and see the other parts. Another thing that I wanted to mention was the student population. I had a chance to talk about the talk with the students, and a few things that was interesting. First, 60-70% of the population of the students were women. And women and men study together, unlike in Saudi Arabia. They were separated in different campuses. And We were told that there were some female professors, but we met only one through our visit, and we haven't met any other. There was some of the problems the students mentioned that was that finding jobs afterwards. And because of this rise of student female student population, the government was proposing an affirmative action for men, meaning at least the 50% of the students should be men. So it was sort of this debate on how to balance. And women mentioned that there were various reasons for them to devote themselves to studying in university. It provides them with more liberty. It provides them, gives them the opportunity, and the Iranian society values education truly a lot. And then it also gives them an opportunity to move away from their family pressures and delays marriage. And but what happens afterwards is that there are not as many jobs for women as men, although they can do anything in society, like we met some women lawyers. But the options, opportunities were much more limited, and many would end up marrying and having children. So that was a little frustrating for them. Another thing that was interesting about the students was that although they were very creative, very dynamic, they could speak different languages, at least two languages other than their own language. But they were feeling the pressure of the social, political, and economic struggles of their country. For example, some of the students who were born at the time of the Iran-Iraq War, they were very sort of going through a post-war syndrome of this sort of a sense of frustration, and they were fully aware of the consequences of war, and they were very much interested in getting to know United States more. Many of them were interested in coming to the United States doing PhDs or other programs here. And one of the reasons for that was that they felt United States was very cutting edge in some of these issues on human rights, peace, education. But it was not many opportunities for them. Just to get a visa, they have to go to somewhere else, and it's a very long process. And so there are many European countries, especially France, have been very active in providing opportunities for Iranian students. But they were very interested in coming to the U.S. Finally, I would like to very quickly mention how some creative ways they have been addressing some of the contentious issues. For example, it was very important for the people that we met that they frame political issues within the academic framework, rather than talking directly from a political perspective. Emphasizing it as an academic, as a scientific discussion was very important, and it gave them more opportunity to talk about things. And we were I was surprised to see that many of the participants who came with us to Qom, the religious center from Tehran, how comfortable they were asking very challenging questions to the people, questioning about abuse of Islam in terms of human rights, etc. And that was something that we felt was, although there was a camera, as long as they framed the questions in an academic framework, they felt more comfortable posing challenging questions to religious leaders or other actors. And I think that was quite interesting. And finally, they were very well informed in terms of the cutting-edge theories and perspectives. And they had some very interesting publications, books on human rights from a secular and from an Islamic perspective, and finding linkages between those things. And I think these are some of the points that I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Aisha. Kamar?
I think, can you hear me in the back? Good. I think what you'll find is we had seven folks on the delegation to Iran. While we all focus on peace building or conflict resolution, we have different trainings and different discipline trainings. And as a result, it seemed really healthy that when we were there, we were able to talk to each other and see our own different observations and analysis, and actually to use each other or help each other see if we are observing these things correctly or not. And I found my other six colleagues there, their observations quite different. And we had obviously many common places that we met in terms of our observations. One of the things we didn't speak about, and maybe it's so obvious to everyone, and maybe we'll bring that up later, is just the general infrastructure. From Tehran down to Isfahan, it's about a 7.5-hour drive, and we went on a three-lane highway, and this sounds weird, but there wasn't a pothole from Tehran all the way down to Isfahan. And the reason I look for potholes is because driving here in this city, you lose a tire every other day driving around. So that really bothers me and bothers my pocket. So I was really impressed by the infrastructure. And Tehran itself has 38 highways, or what we call turnpikes or highways, in that one city. I just wanted to begin with that because I think it speaks about something that is happening, and we noticed immediately something that is different from our experiences from other Middle Eastern countries, coming from whether it be Egypt, Morocco, Iraq, or Turkey. I mean, something was definitely different once we landed, and the infrastructure just struck us. The cleanliness, the discipline, the public sphere, the middle class, and their easiness to discuss their issues, to discuss reform, promoting democracy, the more recent cars, French cars, German cars, Italian cars, etc. All of that. It's just the infrastructure, just the moving around and interacting and able to forge relationships very quickly, I think helped us with our sort of Iran immersion program. So all of us have focused on many different things, and I just like to focus on two or three things just to add to this conversation. And one of the things I like to start off is, my background is in history and religious studies, and one of the things that you'll find very clearly is the language, what people use from, the humanists, right, the university professors of law or sociology or social scientists, and the language of theologians. Now, here in the States, we say that it seems so obvious. What I notice is a little different here. The humanists, our friendly scholars of law, would like to use religion and to in replacement of Islam. So when they meant religion or they meant Islam, they actually meant, they used the word religion. And they were still struggling with, because of their current Islamic Republic, about the place of religion in politics and authority. It seems like something straight out of 17th century European literature. But when we speak to theologians or grand ayatollahs or the seminarians, they didn't use religion, they didn't use Islam, they didn't use any of those. In fact, what they used were very basic theological terms of God, creation, creator, divine presence, and all good comes from God, and human work is from this divine being. In fact, one of the things that this grand Ayatollah Sana'i said, he started off with this Dua Amila, which he said the Khomeini used in Najaf. He was in Najaf for 15 years, and he said for 15 years he recited this supplication. And he said that supplication, it's recited all the time. So it's accredited to the fifth imam. Iranian Shiites have 12 imams, and the fifth imam, Zain al-Abidin, said this, and this is a quote of the supplication. God, give love to all. God, your love is to all creation, and please may your love to all not damage the environment and protect all creation. This is how he started his conversation, and it goes on to proceed that particular supplication he says every single day to his students, and this particular grand Ayatollah has about 3,000 students, and he starts that in his classes, and now his students say that to his future students. And what I'm trying to say is that the language is very important if you pay attention, because there within the languages you hear the nuances of self-criticism, the nuances of understanding of the self in that state. You hear the nuances of promoting democracy or promoting the state or promoting resistance or promoting different types of change. Within the languages, you hear oppositional voices as well as traditional voices that support a theocratic state. One of the most interesting things, and I'll get back to this Ayatollah Sana'i in a moment, but I was really struck when we were in Tehran, was when our colleagues at the university, who for lack of a better term, we call them humanists, who is clearly against the current state and every level, deny and read the basic books of Imam Khomeini. And here I am sitting in Tehran and asked, well, do you know why? Remember when Khomeini said this in Hukumat Islami in his book on Islamic governance, so and so and so, and this professor of law said, no, we never read that. we don't read that here, we don't read that there. But they were so more comfortable in what? Speaking about Nietzsche and Kant and speaking about different Western philosophers and different human rights organizations and the latest report from the UNDP and so forth, because that's their training and that's their orientation. So what we were struck immediately was not only focus, language, emphasis, and priorities of what is important to them, but also the de-emphasis of their own society and their own cultural, theological languages and histories. So in one way, I thought we would see some common shared values between our humanists and theologians. Yes, they were, but the unshared values are very, very striking. So the use of religion by our colleagues at the law faculty really are saying things that, religion cannot answer the question and cannot solve every problem. Religion is easily misused, misappropriated, and our lovely friends, the Ayatollahs who are running the state, have no clue about basic or DNA about social sciences. And then I think what was most interesting, and maybe you'll find this interesting, is that when our colleagues did accompany us to Qom, a city of seminaries, they were struck by libraries. They were struck by Ayatollahs who have two PhDs, one in Western philosophy and one in Buddhism, and also who spent 22 years in seminary. They were struck by Ayatollahs calling each other not Ayatollahs, but Dr. Mukhtar or Dr. Hussein. They said, wow. They think they're westernized. It's sort of a critique of the humanists, of the theologians, and it was this back and forth of criticism. And sometimes it was nuanced, sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it whispered in your ear, sometimes it was very loud and very public in the camera. So I just wanted to make that clear that this sort of self-criticism is so strong. And at one point, and maybe the second day, I said, maybe this is so polarized, but I really got to appreciate it by the third or fourth day, that yes, it's polarized, but there's a respect of the polarity of thought and practices. So as much as our colleagues from the university weren't very happy to be in the sort of sacred ground and in Qom, they were there, and they really learned a lot. At the end, the professor said, before coming here, I used to think we have to do nothing with these Ayatollahs and the religious class. Now, after 3 days of being in Qom, I've learned we have to work with them. So in a sense, while we're learning for something, it seemed like our own colleagues were learning from their own personal experiences, leaving Tehran and meeting theologians in the city of Qom. Just to give you a sense of our lovely friends in the law school, we walked maybe 20 minutes away from the university, and we were in this bazaar. The bazaar has this shrine. The shrine is the son of the...
Al-Kadhimi.
Yes, the son of the seventh imam. That's a major person, not only in Islam, but in Shiism. None of our colleagues from the university knew that this existed, nor knew about the shrine itself. So one can say, sure, people do these things. But I think it indicates sort of the resistance to see anything religious or anything dealing with religion, to turn away and lead your own separate and private lives from that. I just want to add two other points that I think that may be interesting. So we've met a great deal of different experts, NGOs, academicians, high-ranking religious scholars, students, and social scientists, and once most interesting, the lawyers and Human Rights Commission. The group that I'd like to pinpoint right now is the Islamic Commission on Human Rights in Tehran. They have a very sophisticated website, a four-story building in a nice affluent area, and essentially they spent 3 hours with us speaking about how there's currently 2 million cases that they're working on, human rights abuses. This is far too many for them to handle, but they gave us an example of the type of cases. They work to monitor, document, disseminate, and protect human rights human rights abuses. They work in, on the level of children's rights as well as children's abuses. They work for labor rights, women's rights, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these different categories, and if you're an expert in one, they really respect that you stay in that expertise. And within the field of human rights, at least in this, in Iran, they really don't like turf wars. And so they keep this, if you're a children's rights expert, you stay and you do that and try not to move into international rights and so forth. So there was this sort of respect of different disciplines within this field. They also spoke about within this commission, well, I asked them what makes it Islamic, and they said, well, actually, it's just a term. It's actually just to recognize the cultural components of our work and the cultural components of Iran. Actually, there's nothing religious about it. There's nothing historically religious. So Islamic is just acknowledging the culture that they're working in. And one of the other things I think they said is very interesting is that they, as much as they try to be connected with all different types of human rights groups in the world, so with the UN in Geneva, London, France, you find that these folks working at the commission do speak German, French, and English very well and have no problems in moving back and forth. As much as they have some literature from the States, their orientation is within European human rights movements. What's another interesting component of the Human Rights Commission is the fact that they were saying we're not a political group. We're an independent group. We don't promote political activism. We don't support any political group. But when it comes to the abuse of individual rights, human rights, we will step up and step up to the religious elite and political elite to take on these particular cases. So again, it went beyond my expectation to think that I thought NGOs, if you could use that term in Iran, maybe it's just sort of an irony or just, you know, sort of cover, but actually they really promoted their independence, and they promoted their sense of their work and their mission, that the human rights violations, whether it be in France or in Iran, they were very much committed to resolving those conflicts. And so they saw that their work very much in line with many other things. I'd like to say one other point, because I'm interested in how religious studies and comparative religion is taught. And when we went to the Center for Comparative Religion and Religious Studies in Qom, it's a growing institution just being built as we were there. I was able to speak to the person about what type of books he teaches. Like, when you teach Judaism or Christianity, what do you teach? What books do you use? And he didn't show me a syllabus, as Muhammad said, but he said, we use, he said, are you familiar with Dr. Wilfred Smith? I said, yes, I'm very familiar with Dr. Wilfred Kendall Smith. And also, do you know Heschel? I didn't understand what he meant by Heschel. And then it got to a point, yes, Abraham Heschel, I don't understand. So if you're in this world of religious studies or theology, these are standard books that we would use in Western universities. They have translated that into Persian, and they're using that. I said, is there no independent research in Persian of this? And they said, yes, there's many books in Persian. But in terms of Western books, we have translated all these books into Persian and used that in the courses. I found that very, very, not just enlightening, but to use a book by an eminent Jewish American rabbi on the insecurity of freedom, and to have that translated into Persian, and to then use that for your seminary students who are focusing on comparative religion, that is enlightened not only for Eastern standards, but for Western standards. I think my last point, because I know I'm stretching it here, is, and I'd like to open it for question and answers, is this whole point of nuances of self-criticism. While people whispered in our ears to Muhammad or to Aisha or myself and the other delegates of things that worried them, you know, war, defense, what's being said in front of the camera, there was this whole use of criticism through stories and analogies. So when I came back, people wanted to know, well, what's their position on regime change, and what's the position on nukes? And I said, well, people didn't say, you know, nice to meet you, my name is Muhammad, this is my position on nukes. What they did is they said things within a story or within a poetry or within some sort of over the coffee, which is, you know, they had several stories about and I can share one of them right now, which is if someone wants to know your true identity, one time I was driving a taxi, and driving a taxi, I found out I was in Khomeini's section, so I put a picture of Khomeini on my window. The next time when I was driving a taxi, there was a picture of Mossadegh, the socialist leader of the 50s, some of you may remember, and we put his picture on the window. So someone asked me about my position about something, and they said, "Oh, you're now driving in this town, and this is the and this is the authority of someone." I've forgotten. He says, "Oh, I don't have that picture, but just leave me alone. My position is I'm a family man. I love my family." And he put a picture of his family on his window. And I think he was trying to tell me that while there are many sensitive issues, that through these stories, there is a great deal of ways of figuring out you can work with different positions, work with different conversations, but when it comes to very difficult conversations, you know, this particular person would say, "I'm a family man. Just give me a break." So, thank you.
For those of you who have questions, we have microphones on. I think there's just on this side. If you would come and line up behind the microphone, I will call on you. But while you're gathering, let me just pose one question to our presenters. How much did the people, particularly in Qom, respect your knowledge of Islamic peacemaking? How much did they feel that they could learn from you? Were your perspectives enlightening to them, or were they resistant and feel that you came from a different tradition within Islam and didn't really have anything to contribute? Or was there room for mutually enlightening dialogue on issues of Islamic peacemaking? Any of you that may want to... Muhammad, you want to...
Yeah, I mean, in general...
That's all.
In general, that was the primary interest that I've had. I wanted to engage with people on that level. And I think that my weakness on this, that I didn't look yet in depth on the Shia theological framing of peace and conflict resolution. I've done that in the last 3 years through research on the Free Muslim Association, looking at Imam Shirazi literature, which is the primary Shia theologian who written about nonviolence and peace. But I couldn't talk about Shirazi there for many political reasons in his relationship with the Iranian regime. But there was great interest in the way we frame professionally the field of peace and conflict resolution. And I thought this is something we bring as American academic and scholars into this conversation. They don't have that yet capacity and the structure to have journals, to have books, to have syllabi specifically on that subject, and they were very interested in that. In fact, a couple of them wanted immediately to sort of sign a contract to translate some of our books on nonviolence in Islam, and were very sort of hungry for this type of material. I don't think they saw us as a Sunni ulama scholars, which we did not present ourselves as theologians. So I think there, in Qom, there wasn't a balance in that interaction. They considered themselves as a Shia theologian, and in that context, they could offer lots of books and material from their tradition. And I think that way we benefited more in that context. But I think what we contributed was this presentation of peace and conflict resolution in Islam as an emerging subfield in academic institution here and also around the world, and I think we, to some extent, hook their interest in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I should.
Yes, I would like to echo that. I think one of the things that was very new for them was the field of conflict resolution, and we had to sort of explain what the field was about, some of our main concepts. But another thing that was very important for them to, and they wanted to learn, was the role and the status of the Muslims in the United States. We're asked what can or how can Muslims in the United States facilitate some sort of dialogue, and what are some of the advantages of living in the United States for Muslims. And I think that was quite interesting. We mentioned about the diversity in the United States among the Muslim community and how we had to find a way to address our concerns and differences in ways that are within the American system of democracy and respect. And I think that was also something that they felt that was very important for them to learn.
Joe? You want to introduce
yes,
yourself,
sir.
Identify yourself?
My name is Joe Monfield. I traveled with Aisha and Muhammad to Riyadh last year, but since I didn't qualify as a Muslim, I couldn't go to Iran. I don't have a question, but I have a commendation. I think this is USIP at its absolute best in using resources, congressionally appropriated resources, to send an all-American Muslim delegation to Iran at a time when politically there's such emphasis on or attractiveness to focusing on Islamophobia and very much in the political environment, and to present a nuanced and rehumanized image that they themselves confess they didn't have before the trip. That's why it's so important to take this. Is this C-SPAN or just a USIP streaming?
This is Voice of America.
Voice of America. It's really important that this tape be made available on the web for a long period of time. I'm really, really impressed with all of, you know, from Dick Solomon all the way down. You, David, have taken a big lead in this area, and my travel mates and Kumar also. So, mazel tov.
Thank you. Peter.
Peter Gubser, recently retired, now a historian. First of all, I want to second what Joe said. I thought it was just an excellent, excellent presentation. I'm so pleased you've done what you've done. You said you've been in Riyadh recently. I'd be very interested to hear some comparisons, contrasts, two or three points on each side, of what Riyadh was like, or Saudi Arabia, vis-a-vis Iran. It would be very, very interesting for me. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, Peter, why this question? the delegation with Joe and Mary King and also Aisha, myself, and Betty Sitka from the AU went actually to Al-Imam University, which is one of the most both conservative as well as religious academic institutions, with about 50,000 students, all paid tuition in Riyadh, and the university reached out to us through ex-ambassador here in town and invited us, and we were probably the first American delegation to make it on campus and exchange some views on how to promote Islamic peace, Islam and the human rights, Islam and democracy, Islam and conflict resolution, women in Islam, and the exchange with the group was very fruitful, and we still actually after a year or so trying to follow up with it. Both the ambassador changed and the minister and the head of the university changed, not because of our project, for other reasons. So we're trying to revive that. One of the main insights I've had immediately when I arrived is the issue of the infrastructure. I mean, it was very clear that there is somehow more of sense of both infrastructure as well as organization, you know, aesthetic, you know. There is something else in Iran that I've got. One of the students told me that Iran is only not about Islam, and he told me that in the first day, in the first 3 hours. Iran is not only about Islam. Within that, you should look at the Persian civilization. And he was a master's student, my orientation, I'm just getting with my jet lag, didn't really give it much thought in the beginning. But in the last day, I really figured out that this is really where a case where Islam and Persian, very old, deprived, sophisticated Persian civilization have meshed together in a way where you cannot really understand it without looking beyond that. Mm-hmm. I did not find that in Saudi Arabia, of course. I found there more of a similar, but maybe, you know, because I'm also an Arab native, I didn't look for something else, and the Arab tradition tribal was very clear to me there, and that's different context. Second is the issue of gender. In Saudi Arabia, we did, and you know, maybe Aisha also can respond to that because she was in both of them, the level of coverage, the level of separation, the level of space maneuver for male, female in public space was much more restricted in Saudi Arabia than in Iran. In Iran, we saw lots of contacts and the space for interaction between between the two. The level of sophistication and critique by civil society we engage with was far more higher than what we saw in Saudi Arabia. But this could be because of our host in both sides. You know, if we had different hosts in Saudi Arabia, we might have a different dynamic. But I think those are two simplistic observations. I'm not sure, Peter, if this responds to you, but that's the initial response.
I should. Can I?
Yes, I think I would agree with that, and I would specifically mention that in Iran there was this level of education beyond Islamic sciences, whereas in the Al-Imam University there was a not only an absence of Western education system, religious education of other religious traditions, but there was one particular Islamic perspective going back to one particular person in the Sunni tradition. And at the same time, what there was, women and men were completely separate at the university, and we asked to visit the female section, which was in a completely different part of town between locked doors, and our entrance and exit was even very carefully organized. But they informed us that they were going to have a section of the women's section within the main campus, because they had an amazing campus for the men, but the women's facilities were much more poor. I think that was the poorest I've seen in all of my experience in Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, in our closed meetings, they were more relaxed, and they were saying that you don't even have to cover your hair here if you don't want to, or you can be more relaxed. But also, in general, in public, in Iran, women and men go together, you know, young girls and boys, they have boyfriends. They said, like, not like the way we would understand it, but it's more easy for them to go out and meet each other, do things together. But in Saudi Arabia, women cannot even go out alone. They cannot drive cars. In Iran, you could see women driving their jeeps and SUVs and etc. as well. So it was much more relaxed in that sense. But in Saudi Arabia, that was much more conservative. I think that was two main very big differences.
I need to qualify. I mean, we are really providing you with some impressionistic, mm-hmm. you know, first-hand experience. I really need to qualify all of this information. We're not doing comparative regional study here in our presentation, so please take this in this qualifying note.
Sorry.
Yes.
Hi, my name's Saad. I'm actually a research assistant here at USIP, and I'm a student of Middle Eastern Studies at George Mason University. I was wondering, in situations like Iran, where there might be some sort of animosity towards the West, whether for historical reasons or current political, how do you package these conflict resolution theories and practices when they're being presented by, like, a Western delegation that's educated in the West and they're essentially Western models?
Actually, it's fairly easy because I finished a PhD in George Mason in conflict resolution in 93, and within a year I realized that what I studied could be obsolete in Gaza or in Mindanao or other places. I went there with very organized documented manuals and getting to yes by Fisher. But you know, within 3-4 days you realize that the principles would work, but the technique are not necessary, are out of sync in that sense. What worked for the Harvard Northeast Boston scholar of conflict resolution doesn't necessarily work in the Muslim cultural context. And from 93 on, I began looking with other colleagues, how does Islamic theology, Islamic culture, Muslim culture, Arab culture deal with peace and conflict resolution, and that's how we packaged it. We did not talk about this Western mediation, conflict resolution. We spoke about how did the Prophet in Mecca live about 11 years or 12 years without using one single act of violence, but he was resisting persecution, and we called that a non-violence resistance campaign that lasted for about 11 years, and that's one of the longest campaign, and we take stories from the tradition, and we were very interested in learning how the Shia tradition used these resources. So the packaging is from within, from the local culture, from the local religious tradition, and that usually works very well.
Come on.
Just to say, I think there was a camp that actually understood Western models very well. And they're very sophisticated. And they, on the very first day at the chair, we were speaking about positive peace and negative peace, and sort of these various advantages and disadvantages. And so we had this very big, strong reception of why they're valuing such approaches. Is there something else? And how it's connected to the human rights studies and human rights programs. So with a certain group of people, you don't have to package anything. You don't need to sell it. You're already speaking common language. You're building on a discipline they're familiar with. I think it's with the theologians who are just beginning to develop these programs. At one university, they have a program called Religion and Human Rights, and they have a center there, and they have a graduate program there. So I think there's a feeling in one camp that they know this stuff. They're trained at McGill and Oxford and France, so this is no news to us. But then there's another class that's trying to incorporate it with their current tradition.
I also would like to add that I thought before going there would be more negative image of the United States in Iran, but I was surprised to see that people had a more nuanced understanding of the U.S. society because they had access to satellite TV, they had read about it, so they were able to separate governments and people, and I thought that was actually a positive dimension. I never heard it. Actually, I heard a lot of respectful interest in the United States, although there might have been some critique, but they were never aggressive or hostile in a general sense, as if like categorizing all U.S. in one way.
Good morning. My name is Ozzy Saranjbar, and I'm also a student at George Mason. And as an Iranian-American, I want to thank you all for going to Iran and providing your perspectives on a situation that's covered very simplistically in the U.S. media. And so my question is, what can be the role of Iranian-Americans in promoting reconciliation and understanding between both of our governments? We really understand the complexity of the situation, and we have easy access to Iran and don't have to go through the visa troubles that you all did, for example. So I'm wondering, what can we possibly do to enhance understanding between our countries?
Just one suggestion is, I know there are several Iranian-American advocacy groups in town as well as on the West Coast. It just seems that their work just is not... not materializing, it's not disseminated, people just don't know their work. So one thing they could do is probably just be more vocal and promote their work. I know there's a great deal of work on the Hill. The second thing, I think they should really shoot for important measures for this bilateral recognition. I mean, there's no diplomatic ties at the moment for 28 years. I think they should put that as one of their top priorities, and I think they would make a big achievement if they could even just get some sort of recognition.
Many people told us not to go, me and some of the colleagues, and some did a drop. One is about three interesting conversations I had with actually Iranian. About 3-4 months before sought some information. And those three, I spoke with many, but I remember those three in the context of your question, I know what not to do. They try to tell us, discourage us from engaging with the clergy and with the religious Ayatollah, and they said, don't do that. They're not important, they're not central, they should be isolated. And, you know, they were very, very clear about it. And interesting enough, they were younger, sort of in mid-20s and early 30s, and they were very, very adamant, do not do that. You're basically supporting the regime by just engaging with them. And I know this approach, you know, is not going to be both helpful for people we met with and also for my understanding with it. And I think the notion of engagement with people that you disagree with is much more. So that image promoted by certain Iranian here in the town or outside, I think is problematic to totally call for isolation as well.
I was also told not to go, mostly by Iranian Americans who had to leave Iran, and they had a very negative image of the Iranian society and the government. And I think there are some misconceptions about the situation in Iran within the American-Iranian community, I think there needs to be a reconciliation between the Iranian society themselves and to develop a better understanding. I think that would be something.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Greg Aftandilian. I work for Congressman Chris Van Hollen from Maryland. My question deals with the issue of economic sanctions, how the U.S. and UN Security Council economic sanctions may be impacting on Iran, but also as a point of discussion with Iranians. I think Dr. Mohammad Abu-Nimer mentioned the nuclear issue came up indirectly in conversations, but I was wondering if the economic sanctions also came up, and did they blame the United States, or did they blame the regime, or how did that issue come up? Thank you.
I don't know the specific of the sanctions. I don't remember any of those conversations coming up in all of our time. But whenever they felt that Iran was suffering, whether through sanctions or the brink of war, they were really critical internally. They didn't blame the United States. They didn't say it was some conspiracy by Israel. But all of our conversations from day one was blaming a president that is, to say in a nice word, less than competent, and is taking the country to less than intelligent places. So all of the criticism was internally, mm-hmm. and that what we need to do as a society is promote the best in these political positions. So that's an immediate response. In terms of sanctions, I can't tell you if there has been any impact on people or specific, because on my plane from Istanbul to Tehran, it was a 12:30 a.m. flight, and half the flight were from Europeans. So there are European businessmen and women traveling to Tehran, doing quite well, and enjoying their business relationship with Iranians. So I'm not sure if the effect of the sanctions is that visible.
I had a few conversations with younger students on actually sanctions and economic situation, including unemployment. And it was, I think, they were waiting for some United Nations resolution or some discussion at the United Nations, and they seemed very concerned about that, and they were mentioning how the war itself, the Iran-Iraq war, have affected the economy and some of the things that have actually led them to suffer, especially within the field of unemployment. There were some concerns raised by some students, but that was just a very few sample of the people, so I'm not sure how influential it has been in the broader sense.
Again, a brief informal conversation about that, but I think the formal conversation we had that contextualizing the sanctions and the surgical bombing and all this within the context of threat. So I'll go back to the statement that was told to us that the more a threat, the more escalation against the Iranian society, Iranian government, puts us as people who are interested in change and interested in reforms, put us on the defensive and shrink the space that we have in the society to operate. But I think even if the sanctions are not working, or the symbolic presence of sanctions on a society can have also a very strong psychological effect on people feeling threatened and isolated and alienated. And I'm not sure, as somebody who deal with peace and conflict resolution, whether more sanction or less sanction is really, or more sanction is really something that will allow these agents of change to operate.
Thank you for providing this really, really useful talk. My name is Yuta Tobias from the American Psychological Association. And I just realized that you guys are also social psychologists. So I salute you for that. My question is really a recommendation in disguise, and it's related to the comment that a fellow student made. You have proven that contact between people who share social identities works. And I would imagine that not only if Iranian Americans, but all Muslim Americans have an opportunity to serve as mediators of peace. And I wish I were an American Muslim, but I'm not. So my question is, to what extent is your research on the outcome of your trip going to inform action of ordinary Americans who are also Muslims to shape the dialogue that is not happening and to seize the opportunity that they have at this present time, because it seems to be one of the most effective ways to produce sustainable dialogue that we don't have. Thank you.
I want to emphasize again, there were the Catholic University, IFOR, different groups have taken interfaith dialogue delegation into Iran, and there are tourists. Actually, my son goes to one of the schools in Northern Virginia, and his science teacher was a week before. Actually, we overlap about 2-3 days, and she also went to the three cities. So there are also science teachers, there are schools. I'm trying to point that there are different entries for establishing the contact, and we know from social psychology, as you know, that contacts do help, but contact is not enough from the contact hypothesis. But in general, there are different entries. We chose this entry because we thought it's unique and can give us a deeper access. It did in some ways, but I think it cannot be alone or the only one. There are other areas. Also, Iranian themselves were more people interested in different aspects of it, whether women, human rights, academician, clergy, tourist, you know, whatever it is, the entry, I think, should be utilized. So is there a role for Muslim in the U.S. to play? Definitely, but I don't think only in Iran. I think in general, Islam in the U.S. and Muslims in the U.S. have to some extent to flourish in a way and can propose a model where for many Muslim society to not only emulate, but at least to look into it in more in depth, because I think we brought a unique perspective answering that question, how can Islamic identity survive in a Western individualistic capitalist system? And I think, you know, that was an interesting conversation with many people. Some of the Muslim organizations, about 15 of them, under surveillance still, the FBI and security issues. So there is many of those that I approached felt a bit risk. They couldn't take the risk to engage with Iran, but maybe they're willing to engage with Syria or other governments that we have problems with, and there is plenty of those. So there shouldn't be, you know, shortcomings in that part. So I think that could be expanded.
I think United States has the largest number of Muslims who are working in the fields of peace and conflict resolution, and it's unique also that these individuals and practitioners can translate some of these concepts into different Islamic contexts. Not all Muslims share the same cultural traditions as well. So I think they can, one of the contributions they can make is by providing sort of resources for the Muslim communities outside of the United States as well.
Yes.
Hello, my name is Leslie, and I went to Iran in May with my boyfriend in a group called Citizen Diplomacy with Global Exchange. And what we were really struck with was how young a population Iran is. We heard that 70% were under the age of 30, and how very much they like Americans everywhere we went. We had a great opportunity to walk amongst the people. We went to Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, Persepolis. We went to the Caspian Sea, Rash, Musaleh. So we were out amongst people, and we did more tourist things. Did you get an opportunity to be amongst the people, not just organizations, but just the populace? And I heard over and over how much they were so glad that I had come to their country to see for myself, and how they want peace. They just want to be able to go to school and have families, and that our threats of war here in the United States really is clamping down on their civil society, that by threatening them, it makes it harder for their democracy, for their peace movement, their feminist movement. Have you heard that? And do you have any advice? Now that I've come back to the United States, I want to be as effective as possible to make sure that my government doesn't attack Iran. If you have any advice to give to citizens to spread the idea that Iranians want peace. They're beautiful, kind, generous people. Thank you.
Well, I consider the people we met in those organizations and inside the universities and outside the universities, and these several social scientists and theologians, part of the populace. I think they're very much integrated with society, so they're the people that have families, they have lives, they've raised all these children. So, and I think the students were quite remarkable that we met from Tehran down to Qom and Isfahan. We didn't mention one meeting, and it's because of lack of time, really, which is in Isfahan, the University of Isfahan and the Bar Association of Isfahan organized a meeting on peace discourse in Islam. To our surprise, right, the night before we got there a little late and took us out to dinner, so we were out till about 1:32. But to our surprise, 9 o'clock in the morning, there's 400 people in this auditorium, 450 people waiting for us, waiting to hear what we're saying. While we did our shtick on conflict resolution and what we think, they wanted to hear interesting things on human rights abuses in the States. They wanted to know what lawyers in the States were involved with politics and the civil liberties movement. They wanted to know about the rendition. They wanted to know capital punishment, religion, and politics. I mean, this was a very sophisticated conversation for about over an hour and a half by both men and women who were, I think, lawyers and law students and law professors, as well as it was open to the public. And at the end, they said, for our university to have Americans come here to speak about their society and linking it to religion and politics, this was one of the most exciting programs she can remember at the history of the university. And she was a professor there for some time. So in some places, I think we've added to the conversation. Our presence brought people together, had conversations about the United States. Think of us and not just as Muslims, as well as that's important, but also as scholars in the field and trying to do work globally. So I think we got a sense to see a wide variety of Iranian society.
I am not sure what we can do. I mean, I remember the war against Iraq with 30 million people in the street, and I don't mean to be pessimistic. But I know that my kids' school would love a presentation from you. Definitely with this outfit, I think you will you will attract their attention. So reaching out to community, to people who don't necessarily have the chance to, hear beyond the mainstream media, and your personal experience and story is good. I'm planning to do that. I've been talking about it in my classes, but these are captive audience, they can't say no. The problem is to get people who are not captive audience. But I think, that's an issue. There is the capital, there is the advocacy and the lobbying and all of this, and I think that's a different level, different profession. But for many of us, just the simple tell the story about some of the people we met with in the education system is itself is a valuable act.
Yes.
Yes, I'm Rajesh Kadian. I've written some on the Indian subcontinent. So I'd like to take you a little away from what you've been talking about, which has been very informative. The second largest Shia population is in India. And perhaps the richest Shia population outside Iran is in Pakistan. And I wonder how many Pakistanis and Indians as students or on faculty did you find in Qom? And now there's an increasing violence between Shias and Sunnis, especially in Pakistan. Parachinar is going on these days. And what sort of concerns did you find about the Indian subcontinent in your dealings in Iran? Thank you.
We saw Shias from the subcontinent in Qom. We found seminary students, advanced seminary students, actually who was originally from Pakistan and living in Canada but came to Qom to study, and apparently he was an advanced student of comparative religion. We saw it's very common whether you're in Damascus where there are Shia shrines or you're in Qom or Najaf to see subcontinent Shiites there. So we saw them in Qom as well as in Tehran. You can tell through their shalwar kameezes that they are from the subcontinent. But to be honest, I didn't stop them and talk to them and ask them, how is their experiences. Nor did I ask Iranians what are their concerns about the subcontinent. It seems like we were just so focused on our work and with our little time and being moved in different places. Actually, I've speaking to several of these Ayatollahs and Grand Ayatollahs, knowing that I'm originally from Pakistan, they had no qualms or issues or concerns about sectarian violence. They kept asking mainly about politics, like what's going on with the politics and what's happening with the elections and will there be elections. So they're more in tune with day-to-day events than the religious sectarianism.
I think it's a good question, and I think that's another angle we could look at it. Why not to engage with Iran? Because much of the stability of the region, whether it's in Chechnya or whether it is in Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, really have a Shia element. And in the world of Islam, Iran considered as the main hub for that theology and that aspect. And I don't think you can settle a conflict by an American or by a French sending them to Pakistan, to the area where Shia and Sunni. So I think the utilization of the Shia identity that Iran provides is very important, both for diplomacy as well as education. We cannot ignore the role that Iran, positive role Iran, that can play if, that's the big if the engagement in that direction. And I think that's crucial for India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, and the Central Asian countries, is to utilize elements, whether they are political or scholarly Shia, who are interested in this narrative of interfaith dialogue, pluralism, to utilize them into these areas where there's sectarian conflict between Shia and Sunni.
Aliyur Sir, with Rumi Forum. Do you know what's the personal income in Iran?
Of who? I ask, what?
What class?
What taxi driver or or a professor?
In general, what about the wealth of people?
I know the prices in the places where we stay, and the small things we bought were fairly inexpensive relatively to what I found in Middle Eastern countries and other. One of the things in the souk, I know if you're in Jerusalem, they really rip you off in the east part as a tourist. I noticed that, that approach is not there for tourists in Isfahan. But there was an average, I think, of about $1,200 to $1,300 for a senior professor, as I was told by some of the colleagues there that I've asked them. I didn't ask about taxi driver or a worker or cheap labor force.
Per month?
Yeah, I mean, that's what... But this was one of the most senior faculty I spoke to, so this might be a little bit up.
The second question, are they proud of their countries, and also in your friendly speaking with some colleagues, what about their situation, their position in the conflict between United States and Iran? Are they supportive of their country's behavior on that?
Most of the people we spoke to were not supportive of the war and of the violence and escalation. But there is a deep sense of pride. I did not get that in several countries in the Middle East that I met and work with. There is not only nationalist pride, but there is civilizational background that comes with being Persian, I think, and it's there. So they don't necessarily, as foreigners, as external people from the outside, we were not treated as superior gods, with the privileges. I think they gave us very assertive message that despite you're coming from the U.S., despite the perceived superiority, we have something to offer. And they insisted on that throughout all the meetings. Despite you're coming as Sunni, we have also something to offer. Despite you're coming as Muslim, we have something extra also to offer. That line of a pride was always in the meeting. Even in the way we rarely had the panel only ourselves. They always were careful to put somebody also from the local team to respond and engage. So, in the nuances, you see that they wanted their voice to be heard, and they were very assertive about it. And as I said, we met over few hundred people. We never heard a voice that said yes for the violence, yes for the bombing, yes for what's happening into Iraq. They basically were all expressing pain and to some extent frustration from what's happening to them as Iranian, as well as to their neighbor in that part. But again, we're a peaceful delegation. We did not go into non-peaceful situation.
I also would like to add, we met Iranians of different ethnic backgrounds, from mm-hmm. Kurdish to Azeri backgrounds, and they were all very much proud of the Iranianness. So I think that was also very important. Although they addressed some of the issues of ethnic divisions, but they said that was minor, and they were very proud to be Iranians in general.
Thank you.
Take the last question.
Thank you very much. Dwight Bashir with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. Thank you very much for your insights. Really, this has, I think, been a very helpful discussion. I wanted to focus on another angle, and someone who comes from the same institute that Muhammad in terms of academically, but has been working in the human rights arena and frankly concerned about the disconnect actually from those who are working on conflict resolution and peace versus the human rights perspective, which offers a very different perspective. I was struck by the fact that one of the things that you heard from a variety of the different interlocutors was the importance of the rule of law, international law, and human rights kept coming up. The EU and Iran had a more formal human rights dialogue that kind of fizzled out, actually, in recent years. And I know that that's been the primary discussion from a human rights perspective. Yet, from a UN perspective, the human rights record of Iran has been very poor, you know, across the board. And obviously, the U.S., through its reports, have echoed that. So my question really is, how do you reconcile those who obviously are concerned about conditions in the country? And I think some of that comes out from those who are willing to be critical, but, you know, step back from being too overly critical of the regime, given civil society, which I know is very vibrant. And yet, U.S. policy, you know, has been very controversial with regard to promoting civil society. You know about the money that's been allotted, and there's been a lot of controversy about how to, you know, promote and help civil society. So I'm wondering, do you have any recommendations from a U.S. policy perspective how indeed the U.S. can engage or through other mechanisms, whether it be the EU or multilaterally, that would be productive and come about, you know, seeing tangible results? Because I know that dialogue sets conditions for results. However, dialogues in the past, frankly, have not produced results, and the record doesn't seem to be improving, not only internally, but the foreign policy coming out of Iran as well has been not necessarily constructive for different reasons. So I really wanted to get your perspective on, from that vantage point, how do you see progress, not only track two diplomacy that you have been engaging, but from a U.S. policy perspective? Thank you very much.
I'll just verbatim, as close as I can remember, what human rights lawyers told us in Tehran as well as in Isfahan. In terms of human rights, the way they work in Iran, they don't use the shaming method. They don't pull out cases and say, shame on you, and try to take the cases overseas to EU or to the West or the UN and say, you know, this will work if we publicize it, and so then the government will change their behavior. And all of them agreed, I think all these human rights lawyers agreed from both cities, to work within their own constitutional movement, to work within their own political systems, that there's a system, there's a way to appeal for human rights cases, there's a process. As problematic as it is, they all agree that this has to be enriched, expanded, but it has to be worked within their system. So that's one thing I would just want to echo, is that they themselves, the lawyers and scholars, said that the human rights movement cannot be crushed or minimized in its importance. The second, in terms of policy or considering policies, I think it's important to use any available channels. If the EU Iranian Human Rights Commission is available, I think we should work with that. I think right now, if the U.S. does anything on its own, it's very sensitive, and in Iran, people will view that as a way to overthrow its government. So I think right now it's important to build the partnerships that exist in Iran. So I think the EU would be the strongest partnership, or through the UN. Then thirdly, what the most important thing is, all of these lawyers and scholars, human rights scholars, all recognize the importance for international binding rules and treaties. So if it's binding, and if they sign on the line, they really feel Iran is connected, tied to it. They are accountable to the human rights rules, and so they want to hold Iran on those standards, and that's the sort of the logic that they're pushing. So, and they emphasize on those binding treaties. So those are the three things I would immediately put out.
I'll maybe mention one point that we were warned, and I understand it now why, is not to go under the umbrella of changing regime. That wasn't our intention, and that's not something you come in the country to do. So one thing I think for the U.S. policy is first to maybe, you know, I can't say they should, I don't have the authority or the influence, stop trying to change the regime, but at least when you support civil society, when you support the groups or do even give funds for nonviolence, that become ineffective if you title it under this is how we're going to change the regime. And in the preparation even for this talk, we had some conversation, you know, and the main question was, you know, is this going to change the regime? This approach is not an engagement. This is approach confrontation and disengagement. So I think once we away from it, U.S. foreign policy toward Iran might be more productive and more connecting to Iranian, and let Iranian do the world what they think is the best for their country and what the pace of change that they have, rather than us as Americans trying to dictate the method and the pace and the nature of the action itself, and we put the money under the title of peace and nonviolence or democracy. But the big title is really regime change. So that's one thing I know is not going to be effective. As Qamar said, any venue should be utilized. I think there is something going on. The U.S. is talking with Iran about Iraq. So that's a venue, at least, you know, hopefully it will develop to see some common strategic interest there. And several of the Iranians we met with were very frustrated, dissatisfied with what's happening in Iraq, and saw it as a measure also to some extent threat if things get out of hand there for them too. So this could be, you know, a positive connection there between the two countries. But our foreign policy has been very careful to say we're only talking to them about Iraq because of this common and interdependency. I think, you know, as I said, just remove this notion of we are going to change the regime. We're just looking for different ways to do that. Instead, replace it with we're engaging, we're trying to help widen the space for people, Iranian, who are interested in this conversation internal about democracy, change, human rights. And we have many ways in which we've done that in different countries through our aid program, through our State Department exchanges. We're very creative. I think we have creative ways to engage with other people. So, but the title, we're going to change your regime, and here's some money, or not, lots of money, hasn't been very helpful in that sense.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and I particularly want to thank our presenters. And thank the whole team.